Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening from wherever you're listening. Welcome to New Books in South Asia, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ujan. In today's episode, I'm speaking to Katerina Guenzi on her book, Words of Destiny, published by State University of New York Press. Guenzi holds a doctorate in social anthropology from the EHESS Paris and University of Siena. Since 2008, she is the associate professor at the EHESS and member of the Center for South Asian Studies, Paris. She was co-editor of CEIAS and editor-in-chief of the quarterly journal LOM from 2016 to 2020. After conducting ethnographic research on astrological counseling in Banaras, she is in the process of completing a monograph based on her translation of Karma Vipaksha Samhita, an early modern Sanskrit treatise on infertility that combines astrology and past life narratives. Currently, she's based in Chandigarh to investigate the plural landscape of assisted reproduction. I welcome Professor Guenzi to our podcast today.
Hello, good evening for me. Good morning for you.
Yes. So let's start with something biographical. How did you come to write about astrology in particular and India in general?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say that it was my karma. I would rather say that it was a step-by-step choice, and it was because of my training, because I did lots of classics in my previous education and Greek and Latin, so I was interested also in doing some anthropological work that would include also a textual approach, so and to choose a subject that would be related also to textual studies. But about astrology, I would say that I had not planned to work on astrology, but when I went to Banaras I was planning to study some Brahmanical community. I met a woman that was my age. I was 22 at the time, and she was involved. She was doing a PhD in astrology and gynecological problems, women's reproductive health. And I was very much, that aroused my curiosity that a woman of my age was doing exactly the same kind of degree than I was about to do. I mean, in the form, it was very similar to what I was doing. So academic research, she had a research project about the astral influence on women reproductive health, and but so in the form it was very similar to what I was doing, interested in the human being in an academic framework, but in the content it was so different. I mean, for me it was very very surprising to that one could do a PhD in astrology. So it was really this institutionalized aspect of astrology that aroused my curiosity, and that her father was sitting as a doctor in a public hospital, in a governmental hospital of Banaras Hindu University, and he had a salary. He was a functionary, a civil servant there, so in specializing also in medical astrology. And also it was a family. They were astrologers since 9 generations. So I wanted to, so there was this similarity between me and her, Genbati, and this huge difference. So as an anthropologist, I thought that it was something to dig to and to explore further.
Yeah. Right. And so first, did you when you first came for your field work in Benares, and then in your book you talk about the institutionalization of astrology because you talk about the Banaras Hindu University, and so can you walk through a bit of how astrology is institutionalized? Because that part I found very interesting, and I had no idea.
Yes, actually, in 2001. The Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, that is now in power, wanted to promote the teaching of astrology, and especially of Vedic astrology, in Indian universities. And this created a vivid polemic in the public debate, and it was understood, obviously, as a move of saffronization of Indian education to promote especially Vedic astrology in Indian university. But it is true that in Banaras, astrology used to be there in Banaras University long before this Hindutva move at the beginning of 21st century. And because astrology, that is Jyotish, that is a field of knowledge, that a system of knowledge that includes astronomy, mathematics, astrology, and divination, that is epistemologically very eclectic because it includes some subjects that we would now see as scientific and other that are not considered as such nowadays. Jyotish, so Jyotish astral science, including astronomy, astrology, mathematics, and divination, used to be taught since the very beginning of the institutionalization of knowledge, of education, sorry, during colonial times. And especially when the British wanted to create Banaras College, the Banaras College, Jyotish was one of the subjects taught in the Sanskrit college there. And for Brahmins, this was a very important subject because it was one of the subjects that would lead to more occupational opportunities. But for the British, this was very difficult to accept. And I recently published a paper on this, and I'm talking also about this in my book. But so astrology used to be part of the curriculum, and but after the Munich of Education in 1835, when the British wanted to anglicize Indian education, so it was forbidden, and the teaching of astrology was removed from the curriculum. So then at BHU and at some point during 19th century, again, it was institutionalized and again was from, but so the teaching of astrology is there since the very beginning of both universities, whatever is nowadays called the Sanskrit University, Sampurnananda Sanskrit Varanasiya Sanskrit University, and Banaras Hindu University. And Banaras Hindu University in BHU, it is there since the very beginning. So it was in Malavya project since the beginning.
Right. And so let me ask you this, though, which is always very perplexing, is that people now call it Vedic astrology, but there is no astrology in the Vedas. I mean, of course, we know that Jyotisha is part of the Vedangas, but what we classically call the Vedas, there's no Jyotish there, right?
Yeah, there is no Jyotish. There are some elements. So there are two things to be said. There is a treatise which is called Jyotish Vedanga, which is a Vedanga. So, but it's an astronomical and calendrical treatise, and there are no planets mentioned in this, and there is no horoscopy, no whatever we call nowadays astrology, it's not there. And in the Veda, there are nakshatras are mentioned, that is lunar mansions. So there are some astral elements that are used to identify, for example, the appropriate moments to celebrate sacrifice or for marriage. So there are auspicious and inauspicious nakshatra. But you don't have, it is very far and very different from whatever we call nowadays astrology, especially horoscopy based on planetary movements. But still you have some astral and I would say astrological elements there. But of course, when you say Vedic astrology, it's not whatever you will find in the Veda.
Yeah. So at what point do you think that there was, because I know that we know in Varahamihira, by the time Varahamihira was writing Brihat Jataka, we completely have that horoscope and etc. And there's this always, so do you think that it was the Greek influence and from there the Indians learned the planetary system and the horoscope?
There was a transmission of knowledge, this is for sure. There are many technical terms that are phonetic transcription in Sanskrit of Greek words, and many concepts and techniques definitely are of Greek origin. Then about the details, there is nowadays the research is still going on. And, when I wrote my thesis, when I wrote my book, there was one, the only, I would say, the biggest authority, and he's still the biggest authority, is the work of David Pingree, the historian of science, who studied very carefully all kind of transmission of astral concepts between the Greek, the Latin, the Arabic, the Persian, the Indian. He was searching for transmissions, but of course there are also many autochthonous ideas and concepts, and this is only one side of the picture. And nowadays scholars like Bill Mack or Mitriano are some way balancing the picture and showing that there are many indigenous treaties and concepts and ideas that were already there and that made this Jyotish a vernacular science, I would say, even if of course there are Greek elements in it.
Okay, so to come back to the book and the way we are discussing the issues at BHU. So one thing I would ask, because you talked about scholars, amongst anthropologists, there has been sort of a lot less work on astrology than there should be, because it's such a thing. Like we have astrology anthropologists working on various aspects of Indian ritual life, let's say. But we don't have a lot of interest in astrology from scholars. And so why do you think that is?
Yeah, I still don't know why so less studies were done on this subject that is so obvious, I would say, to all observers, to all external observers of of Indian society since the 19th century. The preeminence and the importance of astrology in Indian society is just in evidence, but still very less studies. I think there must be many reasons, and probably astrology is very technical. Is not artistic, is not properly religious, is not fitting our academic divisions. Like, it's not, as if I talk about anthropology, it doesn't fall into medical anthropology, it doesn't fall into religious anthropology. It is always in between, and I think that this might be one of the reasons. The other is that I think there is this suspicion that whenever you are studying astrology, either you believe in it or it is not something serious. And it was always marginalized as a not serious subject to be studied.
I would imagine that to be a very strange, you can say pedagogical or whatever institutional bias, because astrology, whatever your personal feelings are with it, is especially for those who study India, it's something that continues to be so influential in the everyday of the average Indian, more than we perhaps sort of give it credit for. And in the urban areas, of course, you have, and YouTube, of course, has radicalized astrology. There's YouTube channels dedicated to it that daily have things, shows and daily uploads. And there's the same thing in Calcutta, you know, that like you have the infomercials that would once come up like 12 o'clock at night. So they have these Jyotish advertisements, and yeah, people listen to that carefully. So yeah, I mean, I also struggle to wrap my head around why we have this gap in the way we approach astrology, because it's so influential. So yeah, so my next question would be then a bit to ask you about your experience, because you give a very thick description of Benares's astrological scene. And if you could just walk us through a bit of that. So what is it like to be in Benares? What is it? I mean, what's the sort of competitions? What are the main astrological, the way astrology is practiced in Benares?
Yeah, so I can really say now I'm based in Chandigarh for another fieldwork hiking. This confirms me that in Benares, astrology is everywhere, because here I can't see it as much as I could see over there. Of course, there is a structure of the city, the gods, and the touristic areas where astrology is sold to tourists, and this make it very much prominent. Lots of displays of the importance of astrology, and then there are temples and the galleys, and where astrology is advertised everywhere. But then you have also, if you search for them, you'll find that the most popular astrologers are not necessarily those who have an advertisement or who are on internet but who are known from person to person. And that when you'll find many, many people waiting in the waiting room or near the temple, so then you will understand that is an astrologer that is popular, and this is how this was my main criteria, not to search for astrologer who would advertise them themselves, nor to search necessarily for the most knowledgeable or learned astrologers, although I had met some of them, but they were not really practicing, so they were more in academics, and so you have a huge variety of practitioners that go from those who are practicing mixing astrology and other kinds of knowledge, related to Tantra and to Bhut and Pret. And this is one end of the spectrum, and the other would be university professors who would keep themselves very, they have a distant attitude to practice. So they would, so their way of practicing will be very different, but all of them have some clients can be defined as astrologers.
Right. And I read that you met Neelkanth Shastri, and there's a whole lot of myth-making about him, even who have who are mild enthusiasts of astrologers and studying astrology know a bit about him. So I know that you met him and you discussed. So could you explain a bit of how it was, what is his way of working, and how that helped you in your field work in understanding how astrology works in
Yes, so Neelkanth Shastri was probably the most renowned and popular astrologers in Banaras when I was doing my field work. And he had, I would say, a family business, or anyway, he had a kind of structure professional structure. He had two temples, he had an office, and he had really all range of clients, because he used to receive lower classes and lower caste, very poor clients before 8 o'clock, and then during the day the kind of clients would progressively become upper and upper classes, and so was the cost of the consultation would go on during the day till the evening. And it was also, while the first consultation in the morning were very open to everyone, it used to become more and more secret during the day till nighttime, I would say. And he used to, especially, well known for his palmistry, the way he would make horoscopes out of palm reading. So he was writing horoscopes with the 12 houses, but only based on palm reading. And he was very less talkative compared to other astrologers, and especially his brother, who was much more talkative and used to discuss a lot. He was very less talkative, and he would just study for a long time the palm, often very carefully, and then prescribe remedies, but with very little counseling, we would say.
Oh, okay. Right. So what was your sense, like, as doing anthropology in Benares, when you're looking at people coming and going, how would you interpret, or what was your sort of idea of what role astrology plays in lives of people in Benares?
So first I would say that astrology is mainly a middle and upper class practice. The families who are facing problems relating to how to survive, they will not care about horoscope, and so if astrology concerns those families who are in a decision making process. Astrology will be useful for them rather than for those who cannot choose between different options. So it is very useful for a middle and upper class society who have to decide about career, about education of children, about where to live, the kind of house they would have, and this and that. So astrology plays an important role for them also, because in some way astrology is an individualized, I would say that astrology focuses on the individual. And this is also something that, although in my book I show that the horoscope concerns all the family, but still this attention to the individual is prominent, is more important among middle and upper classes.
No. That's perfectly fine. But with that, I wanted to ask you a bit, which I thought that was the most interesting bit about your discussion, was on karma and bhagya. And you explained that karma, though, is a very dominant way of understanding and interpreting Indian existence, or Hindu existence at least. Jyotisha is exactly opposite to that. But for some reason or somehow, they have started accommodating themselves. And I was just very curious to know how that process happened, and how Jyotisha, which is so anti the thesis of karma, sort of acclimatizes itself with it.
Yeah, this is a still open question, and I'm still working on it. And there are different aspects and context, and but in my book, I really, and during my fieldwork, I was very much surprised to see how less importance was given to karma, and astrologers were always talking about bhagya, that is the allotted share. From it is so a word that comes from bhaj, to share, to divide, and it is an idea of having somewhat a wealth that is or a part that is attributed at birth, and that you would be able to increase or that you will lose if you are not doing the right choices. But especially what struck me is it was the non-moral approach that astrologers were, non-moral stand that they would have during consultations, while in karma, the most important thing is the quality, the moral quality of the action that you are doing. So it is punya versus papa. And in astrological counseling, whatever you were doing, aspect that could be like adultery, drug addiction, being very lazy, or not studying, not going to temple. All this was not your fault, but it was because of planets. So it would reverse completely the perspective that you have in the karmic theory, where you are responsible. But then, of course, the two of them are not contradictory, but are rather complementary. And so you can always say that the positions of your planets are there because of what you have done previously in your past life. And so the two can be combined and articulated in one only
but I'm very curious to know, like, for example, this is what most astrologers would say, that, right, like, if you have a bad karma in your past life, your planets are positioned as they are in present life. But if you push that argument to the logical extreme, at some point in time when you're first born or whatever, you had a blank slate, right? So what happened then? And I always thought that that's sort of the contradiction, and they're sort of like two contradictory philosophies that they're trying to bring together to, for some reason.
Yeah, actually, I don't know if they are contradictory. And in some way, I think, because now I'm still working on this question of the articulation between karma and astrology, because I've translated this treatise, the Karma Vipaka Samhita, And it is there, it is still a matter of astrology and karma. And from what I can see, there you have very little astrology and lot of past, in this treatise, lot of past life biographies. So it is the other way around compared to my, to whatever I've observed in Banaras. So the etiology would be on the past life side rather than astrological side. But nakshatras, that is lunar mentioned, are there to tell you which one was your past life. So how to choose your past life, and since biographies are there described. What I want to say is that probably these two, because one, it is clear that in the part of the world where you have the karmic theory, you also have astrology. So I would say the two must work together well to keep, even although they are in some way antagonist and one could also say contradictory, they still work well together because, and this Obey Sekere had remarked about this, in the karmic theory you have lots of unknown. You know, you don't know what you have done. So it is there is this karmic opacity, and astrology brings light on this opacity of what you might have done, because we don't know what we have done in past lives. So one can also say that astrology is very popular also because it brings light on karma, although in a different perspective, of course. And
that's a very interesting way to put it. Yes, it does. That is a very interesting way to put it. But now, I mean, this question is generally kept for last, but since you mentioned, we'll just bring it forward. It's about your next project, which you're saying that this treatise, which talks about past life and how nakshatras can illuminate past life, that seems to be like a very, I mean, I never heard of this text before, so I was very interested to know a bit more about this. So if you could just say a bit on what this text is, how this text operates in terms of explaining past life and astrology.
Yeah, actually, this is a very unusual and original text. There is nothing similar. I mean, there is another one that has a similar approach, but otherwise, it is a very astonishing text. And I came to know about this text through an article written by David Pingree. It is an article about two Karmavipaka treatises, and he's mentioning Karmavipaka and the other one, which is Vridha Suryaruna Karmavipaka. And both of them contains biographies of the passions of astrologers, and especially in the Karmavipaka Samhita, there is the setting of the consultation that is described. So you know that this text has been written for passions who are especially suffering from infertility and other disease or disorders. And you have this, in the Karmavipaka Samhita, the Karmavipaka Samhita develops a very unusual approach, because it is a kind of case studies, because you can see that it is describing, you know, in generally in Brahmanical literature, in Sanskrit literature, you have the paradigm of Shastra that is very much prominent, and in Shastra you always have rules. You have rules, you have theoretical statements, you have norms, and that are always always true, and are not referring to any particular reality or context that it is will not be I'm sorry, you have to cut. There is no singularity. And here in the Karma Vipaka Samhita, the Karma Vipaka Samhita develops an approach that is interested in singularity. So you see that that person who has this kind of problem, who is blind, who is, must have had those life. So, I mean, it is complicated to explain in a very short, but is it one of the few, this you can, what I'm going to say, you can keep it. This is one of the few Brahmanical texts that is putting together seriously karma and astrology in a systematic way, because according to the nakshatra in which you are born, you'll see, you will come to know about your past lives. And also is one of the very few Brahmanical texts where past lives are given to see. I mean, usually common, ordinary people are not allowed to, they don't have the power to see their past life. While in the Karma Vipaka Samhita, past lives become accessible to ordinary person through astrology. I'm sorry. maybe I was not clear, but there are many interesting aspects about this treatise that I was, seems now I'm working on something else.
No, absolutely. I love this explanation because I mean, I know that in South India we have the Nadi, which also somehow mixes the concept of past life and this thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but the thing is, I just know very elementary Tamil. I'm just trying to learn it. But so if I ever learn it, I'll try to do, I mean, read a bit more of the Nadi text, because there's not a lot of translations of the Nadis, and most of them are, and of course, it's a whole different tradition of practicing and so on and so forth. And I don't know if there has been any work in anthropology on the Nadi astrology, but I don't think so.
There is not anthropological, because I think it's very difficult, and especially nowadays it has become very commercial, and so it's not so easy to, and it's also a secret practice, so they are not ready to disclose, I mean, those who have tried. And but you have a textual study by Martin Gunston, which is a textual study, so it, but at least there is a study on that gives some clue.
Idea on I'll just guess we'll have to wait for it when somebody or if finally they open up, but if they don't, that's
but you have in North India you have the Bhrigu Samhita.
Yes,
that
right.
is somewhat similar, and was also mm-hmm. for me difficult to come to know more about the Bhrigu Samhita, because this is also, there is much secrecy about around it.
Oh,
so
right. yeah.
it's not easy to find people who, I mean, many people would say that they have it, but nobody
right.
has seen it.
Yeah, and there's all sorts of stories and lore about, I know one story about R. Santanam. I don't know if that's true or not, but R. Santanam, who edited the now Brihat Parashara Hora Shastra. There's a story somebody told me when I was dabbling in this thing, and he said that, I don't remember what text it was, but it was one of the Vashishtha Nadi or something like that. He called this person and said that I have got the Vashishtha Nadi or some other text that he thought, Santanam thought, was going to reveal a lot more about astrology than we ever know about. But he apparently immediately passed away after that. So, you know, there's all sorts of lores and things like that about that. So we don't know enough about that. But there's a lot of secrecy about astrological text all over. And there's a lot of secrecy in Rajasthan also. I know Rajasthan has its sort of inner ways of working. And I know in Orissa, in Puri, we have a completely different way of looking at astrology.
Yeah, there are so many different regional traditions and practice that should be, I hope, that will be explored.
Good. Yeah, true. So I just have now like sort of the main part of your book, which is about middle-class afflictions. And so if you could tell to those who are listening, what exactly is it? Why exactly is it that astrology appeals to the middle class? Because at some level, you think that people who are educated would think this as superstition and not believe in it. But we know that it's exactly the opposite. But we just don't know why. But I think you give a very good answer why. So if you could just speak a bit on that.
Yeah, when I was observing consultations and when I was discussing with astrologers and with clients, they would also make a difference between Shastric knowledge, whatever is based on Shastra, that is considered to be true and is considered to be rational, versus Laukic knowledge, whatever is popular. And in this category, they used to put like Oja Soka, those practitioners who deal with Bhut and Pret, that is ghostly spirits. And so they used to, and that treat people through exorcism. And so there used to be this fracture between two kinds of knowledge, two kind of practitioners. And I used to think that, okay, so middle and upper class, they would prefer astrology because it sounds completely rational, it's textually based, there is no physical contact between the practitioners and no physical treatment. And so it is very much intellectual, and so it would appeal to middle and upper class, also because if it is expensive and you have these precious stones, and on the other side you have these popular practices through exorcisms, ghost possessions, and where the physics is very much involved, you will see, and is much more performative, I would say. But then what this was at the beginning, I saw like two different worlds, one for middle upper class and the other for low caste and classes. But then while digging and going deeper in the understanding of astrology, and also with Sunita, my friend and research sister, I would say. We were also observing the work of other kinds of practitioners, not only astrologers. And I realized that the differences are mainly in the form, but that substantially, when you look at the way these powerful beings are supposed to act on human beings, take it... in one case, you have Bhut and Pret, like ghosts and demons, and the other case, you have planets, and you have mainly planets who are called Graha, that means Caesars. You'll see that the way Graha are described in the horoscope and the way their influence is described is very similar to Bhut and Pret and to these kinds of malevolent beings who attack and who will stick on the human body and you'll have to remove. And so at the end, I thought that these were two different ways of talking about human affliction by malevolent beings that were, although supposedly very different, they were also very similar. So I thought that, yeah, this was the
So if I would ask you this in another way, and this would be like a bit overreaching, but it appears to me, would you then say that astrology, with its formalized language, acts as what Althusser or other Marxist scholars would interpret as ideological state apparatuses, like some version of an apparatus, ideological apparatus, that preserves class and caste hegemony for the Brahmins and the upper caste.
Yeah, could be. Good point. Yeah, definitely. It has worked as a historian, Chris Bailey, he has shown that astrology has contributed to the pan-Indianization of knowledge and of religion, because astrology is all over different parts and regions of India and contributed, and this is what's also in BHU project of a Hinduization of Indian traditions. But you can also say, yes, that it contributes to keep classes separated. And you, for me, this was very much visible in the remedies also, because middle and upper class would wear golden and silver rings with precious stones, while the lower classes would only wear jantars, you know, amulets in and this is another way of affirming a distinction more in a Bourdieusian sense of
These amulets sort of mark as class identifiers. Like if you see somebody wearing a huge ruby in his ring finger or her ring finger, you know that they belong to a different class, as opposed to if somebody's wearing, let's say, one of those amulets across the neck or arm, you'd know that, you know, they may not be. And it, these arts as material markers of class also.
I think. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And now that you say it, I'm thinking that what we traditionally call as the, in Bengali, we call this the Ojha, which is basically the exorcist. But it's sort of a broad term for people who give remedies for afflictions, like Bhut, Pret, Bhut Badha, and so on and so forth. But there's also this caste angle now, right? Because there's no way that the Ojha is going to be a Brahmin. But the astrologer, more often than not, who's going to give you this formalized treatment of your maladies, is going to be from an upper class. So,
yeah, although it was not the case long ago, I mean, I think few generations, but even maybe one or two generations ago, astrologer, and in different parts of India, they are not always, they didn't have always a high status. And for example, the community of Brahmins that I used to study before coming into astrology as a subject was the Shakadvipi Brahmins. They had a very bad reputation, and in spite of being Brahmins, they were considered as untouchable, and Brahmins would not accept water or food from them. They would not marry to them because they were specializing in astrology, and especially astrologers used to accept Grahadana, that is the gift for the planets, which are particularly inauspicious. And nowadays they are no more accepting this Grahadana. They would say to the passions to offer them to some poor Brahmin street, but otherwise they used to accept this, and so their reputation was, and their status, their purity status, used to be very low.
Oh, that's an interesting caveat. That's very interesting. And so the final part of your book talks about remedies, which we already touched upon a bit. And this sort of ties to this broader question that you also discussed, that sometimes, okay, see, that's, sorry, we'll have to redo this because somebody outside my house decided to bang something. I don't know. So we'll just redo this. So, yes, so the last part of your book talks about remedies, which we touched upon briefly. But I just wanted to know, and you talk about this elsewhere also, is that sometimes the astrologer's prediction would fail, right? And then how would the clients and how would people in general make sense of that and still keep believing in the practice?
Yeah, so this happens very often. I would say this is the regular working of astrology, is a permanent bargaining of truth, I would say. They keep negotiating the truth, and of course, prediction, not only in time, but also sometimes they only have the horoscope, so they would have to guess who's the owner of the horoscope, and they would say, so like, she's very bright, and the mother say, oh no, she has lots of problems at school, and so she's very, oh, but she can see that she's very tall. Oh no, she's not very tall. Oh, you can see that she's quite thin. No, she's very fat. Okay, so it's like the last thing would be, so she has black hair. I remember an astrologer said, so she has long hair, long black hair. And the mother said, no, she has very short hair. So there, the bargaining comes to an end. And so there are this kind of exchange are very, of course, very often. And they have to, so astrologers and patients have to find their a meeting point where there are two versions of reality would meet, the one that is described in the horoscope and the one that is perceived by the client. But usually when they have to decide where is the truth, they would, both of them would rely on the horoscope and keep hold the horoscope as a truth that cannot be questioned, while the reality that is perceived by passions can always be questioned, because they can, like in my book, I'm describing this case of a woman who just delivered a baby, and she's a girl, I think, if I remember, and he's saying, but you should have had the boy. And she's saying, but he's a girl. And so he says, but maybe because you had C-section, someone has changed the baby. And they can always question, even, you know, if someone is nice to you, you don't know. I mean, they can also question whatever is the perceived reality. And so they will instigate, I don't know if you say instigate a doubt, they will instill a doubt in the person. And these doubts are always there in the perception of, like, about the age of the girl. If you doubt about the age of the girl, there are so many people who are lying about the age of the girl that it can all... it makes sense. And so at the end, they would, if nothing is matching with the perception of the passions, and passions are insisting that this is what they perceive, that the girl is such and such, or that the boy is such and such. So at that point, the astrologer would say that this is not the right horoscope. But maybe I would say that the horoscope is kept as an unquestionable truth, and is the reality who has to be questioned. I mean, maybe you have not understood what was in front of you. Maybe you misunderstood what happened. Maybe, and so astrologers are there also to make people questioning their own perceptions of the reality.
Yeah, and you say that this comes from this idea that the gods' language was corrupted by men later. And so what is that? I found that very intriguing.
Yeah, I'm quoting Charles Malamud, very interesting studies. It's out of context because he's mostly talking about Vedic gods and Vedic God's language, but I like to match that his view, and that I wanted to mention it, to refer to it. But it's true that there is this idea that whatever is written in the horoscope, it's clear and it's much more luminous and it's brighter than the reality that is in front of us, which can be misleading and is not reliable. It's too complex to be trusted. And our perceptions are fallacious.
So I guess we're nearing an hour, so I guess we'll wrap up now. And then I don't have any other question, but I just, before we sign off, I just have to ask you this: that have you ever been interested in looking at astrology? Because one thing that is that I have seen around me, and especially after coming to the US, I've seen that astrology is very popular amongst the NRI Hindus, and there is, like, people would come to language schools to study Sanskrit so that they could do astrology, and there's annual conferences and things like that. And did you ever have any idea of working on a diaspora community of Hindus who also are for some reason very obsessed with astrology? And
No, I haven't. I think that it would be maybe more difficult because of many reasons, because of the ideological in the diasporic communities there are also the borders between academic and non-academics are very often blurred, and there are also many American WASP, I would say, that are considered themselves as Hindu. So it would be difficult also to say where does it finish, this diasporic community, and where does it start, the American. I'm always interested in India, but I hope that someone else will do. Sure, it is very important and it's very, very influential. It's absolutely influential, and American astrologers are not only NRI, are considered as authorities even in India, and some of them and their books.
Wow. Okay. I guess, and that's an hour, so I guess, and it's pretty late for you too, so I'll just say just thank you for being with us today and discussing your wonderful work, and I wish you all the best for your future project, which I'm sure is going to be a very influential contribution to the astrological ideas about astrology, in both in terms of textuality and in terms of anthropology.
Thank you so much for inviting me to discuss.